Good day, everyone. This is Brenda speaking. Welcome to the IRP IoT meeting number 78 on the 12th of October 2021 at 1700 UTC. Today's meeting is recorded. Kindly state your name before speaking and have your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking. Attendance is taken from Zoom participation. Apologies received from Flip Petillion and Mike Rodenbaugh. And with that, I will turn the meeting over to Susan. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. Thanks everyone for joining. This is our regularly scheduled call on the 12th of October. As usual, we'll kick off by reviewing the agenda and seeing if anyone has any updates to statements of interest. In fact, I'll do that bit first and pause and see if anyone does have any SOI update that they need to flag to the group. Okay, I'm not seeing any hands or hearing anyone, so I will take that as no, we don't have any updates for at this time. Next up on the agenda, we have a couple of action items from the last meeting. One was for me to finally get around to seeking volunteers for small groups to try to advance some of the outstanding matters. And in particular, to focus on outstanding matters on the IRP rules, as opposed to some of the other matters that are sitting in our inbox, if you like. So I have got that down as an agenda item to come back to. So we'll come on to that shortly. The second item was an action item for Malcolm to suggest some draft language relating to tolling. And that arose out of our discussion on the last call about the timing of different accountability mechanisms and concerns that if we were tolling for one or more of those, that we could be essentially significantly extending the time before an IRP would be brought, potentially therefore undermining the concept of the IRP as a swift resolution of dispute. Malcolm has circulated some draft language today in the form of a PowerPoint presentation. I'm hoping he will join us. If not, I perhaps will just quickly present it to everyone. And really it's just as a sort of first look for people. Obviously not everyone will have had time to review it and we don't have everyone on the call. So I certainly would look for us to engage on that further on the email list and then come back to it. So agenda item three is as I just mentioned, to talk about the subgroups. Then agenda item four, and this is our sort of substantive topic for the call, is to come back to the draft language for the safety valve for the repose. That was language that was circulated by ICANN Legal, and we've had it in the form of a Google Doc, which has been open for people to insert comments for a couple of weeks now. And so I'm hoping that we can talk specifically about those comments and review them and reach a sort of path forward on that language. So very much encouraging people not to start raising new points that haven't been put in as comments in that Google document, unless you feel that it's something that absolutely has to be raised. But you know, we're trying to move our work onwards by trying to work offline outside of outside of the meetings as much as we possibly can. And then the final item on our agenda is just to flag the next meetings, and I'll quickly mention that now in case I mismanage the timing of the call again. We Bernard had sent an email suggesting that we might try and have calls on either side of the ICANN meeting, in particular, since we had a bit of momentum going and we will lose a week for the ICANN meeting proper. We were proposing that in addition to meeting this week, we would also have a meeting next Tuesday. And that was put out to the mailing list for any comments. The only comments we had, and I think it was just one comment, was favourable. Haven't seen any objections. And so that's our intent, that we'll meet next week, and then we'll meet after the ICANN meeting on the 2nd of November as well, so that we don't lose too much momentum and too much time, especially as we're sort of coming into the kind of holiday season. It would be, you know, beneficial for us to keep things moving as far as we can. So I don't see Malcolm with us at the moment. I will I'll therefore turn to I think perhaps we'll hold fire on talking about his draft language on the tolling and see if he is able to join us. So first up then I on agenda item three is really just to flag for those who haven't had a chance to sort of look and think about this yet, that I have, or Bernard on my behalf has circulated now my suggestion on how we might break up some of the tasks on the rules into subgroups to try to take the work forward. And I'm looking for volunteers for people to join some of those efforts. Have had some volunteers already on the email list, which is great. And so hopefully just this is really just to flag to you all and you know, hopefully encourage you all again to look at the list of items and the suggested breakdown of how we might structure it, and to sort of, you know, put your hands up for particular groups to work off outside of these main meetings and try and take it forward. And I think I'm currently proposing kind of four subgroups. We do have a group already on consolidation that did meet for a while. We lost a member in that Helen, you know, changed roles and left the group. It's basically looking at consolidation, but it also covers a couple of the other items from our sort of outstanding item list. So it's consolidation. It's about elimination of the procedures officer or use of a different terminology. And it also, I think, sort of, there seems to me to be a reasonable sort of overlap with the interim measures and the practice for using an emergency panelist. And so I think that it probably makes sense for those efforts to be combined. The next one is that there were various sort of questions around the selection of arbitrators that we had on our list of issues, including considering whether to better align the Article 3 language with the ICDR rules, particularly about the procedure where there's how to appoint a third panelist where there's disagreement. Potentially considering whether we feel that we need to have any kind of specification on the nationality of arbitrators, and whether there should be one or more from the same nationality, or indeed whether it's whether we need to address the nationality of the parties and the nationality of the arbitrators. I think, again, I think this is something that groups should think about. Obviously, when they're thinking about it, they will also have to have in mind the fact that we will be having a standing panel, and therefore, you know, to some extent, you know, the pot of who to select from will be necessarily pretty small. And then the other item on in relation to selection of arbitrators related to thinking about sort of having greater clarity on when the IRP panel is in place, which would give sort of clarity to when you might need an emergency arbitrator. That does sort of slightly overlap with some of the consolidation work, but I'm hoping that it operates as a standalone. I didn't want to give that consolidation group all of that to look at, and so at the moment I'm proposing it's two different groups, but we will have to see if it proves to be unworkable. The next group was to be looking at the initiation of the IRP, and in particular this is firstly around the sort of fee to initiate the IRP, where a question has been raised about whether the current procedure of having complainant pay a fee is in line with what the bylaws say. And again, this is not to prejudge that question by having it on the list. It's essentially to have a small group look at that and make a decision, and if necessary, make a proposal if they feel some changes needed to the procedure. And it sort of ties in as well with a point on the time for filing around clarification on when the IRP is officially commenced, and particularly that sort of also ties in with failure to pay a fee, and so it clearly is relevant if we were to have a proposal that there's a different procedure for dealing with the fee for the IRP, then those two things need to be lined up. And then the final one was around the procedure where or if ICANN elects not to respond to the IRP. I think we all probably think this is relatively unlikely to occur, but the bylaws certainly allow for that. And we don't really have anything in the rules that's covering it off. And so it would be, I think, useful for a group to think about that as well, and see whether we need to be proposing some additional rules to cover that scenario. And then on our action list or our list of outstanding issues, specifically about the rules rather than about some of the other matters on our list, we also have appeals, a question of whether we need fuller rules for appeals, and if we do we have a separate set of rules, or do we feel that this should be dealt with within these specific IRP rules, about non-binding IRPs and precedent and whether it's within our remit or not, and whether there's an ambiguity about the standing panel's ability to adjudicate a stay or to recommend a stay. And this was something that David McCauley raised in an email a little while back. I haven't allocated them to subgroups because I think that we need as a group to be considering how best to handle, and indeed whether they're within our scope, before we start looking for volunteers to work on any of those. So that was what I was proposing. I hope it makes sense. If anyone has any suggestions, and particularly if you feel something, if anyone suggests a better way to do this, then I'm certainly all ears. But otherwise, I'm keen to just get some volunteers and hopefully get some work going so that we can try to crack through this now. David.
Thank you, Susan. Hello, everyone. It's David McCauley speaking. I have been away the last several working days with my grandchildren, which is the good news for me. But what it means is I'm just catching up on list now. So apologies for not answering some of these things. But what I'd like to say is I think your suggestion looks good. And I would like to volunteer for a number of the groups
not consolidation because you already have that in hand, but maybe the others. And I have a question about it too. And that is, so do you expect that the subgroups will meet every other week? And when you say, I mean, I think it's a fair comment to reserve some things for full group discussion, but I don't think that means, and I'm asking you, I don't think that means that the work that subgroups produce won't come back to the full group for sort of a final blessing or something like that. But I think it's a good approach. I think it'll help us move more quickly, and I'm happy to volunteer for as much as I can. Thanks.
Thanks so much, David. Yeah, absolutely. I certainly am not anticipating that subgroups will be making final decisions. I'm very much hoping that rather in the way that we've used subgroups in some of the PDPs and other work efforts, that it's sort of, you know, a group can take a sort of, you know, a really sort of decent first pass and explore the issues and come back with a recommendation, but that it would be for the full group's blessing or indeed rejection. You know, that it would be perfectly possible for the full group to reject, ideally not based on a consideration which had been fully explored. But ultimately, you know, it's the role of this group as a full group to be making these recommendations. And so we can't sort of delegate that responsibility. In terms of how frequently we meet, we might look at having a couple of it may to some extent depend on how many people are across multiple groups. We might sort of kick off with a couple of these groups and then move on to another couple once some of that work is wrapped up. It may not be possible to have four groups going in parallel, I think. But yes, I'm sort of envisaging maybe they could meet during the off week of the full group meeting or something like that. Not necessarily on a Tuesday, but hopefully we could get at least two subgroups going at a time. Subject, as I say, to how much overlap there is between members. David, I think that's a new hand.
It is. Thanks, Susan. And your answers make sense to me. I think it's a good suggestion. But I raised my hand again because you mentioned something that I forgot to speak to, and that is this idea of non-binding IRPs and precedent and all. I did ask that question, or I did mention that in an email, and Mike Rodenbaugh asked a question about it in his email earlier today or yesterday, I forget when it was. So I thought I'd make just a little bit of an explanation of what I was getting at, if you don't mind. I'll just take a second to sort of explain that. But what I was doing was I was flagging an issue that I thought this group should look at. And so one of the bylaws, I don't have it in front of me, but one of the bylaws says that appeals, you know, are subject to limitations that may be developed. And I thought that, you know, I posed a question, should we develop a limitation that non-binding IRPs are not appealable? There is a potential to have a non-binding IRP. And I, you know, so I said, why don't we look at the question, should they be appealable? And then I was asking a related question, you know, if they're not appealable, you know, would a non-binding IRP be considered precedential? Should we, you know, and I was also making the point, if we find that something like that is beyond our remit, should we, when we conclude our work, make a report to ICANN that says, you know, here's our work. And oh, by the way, we saw a number of issues along the way that we thought should at least be considered by the community. And the reason I say that is no one or very few folks in the community are going to know bylaw 4.3 the way that we do. And it struck me that, this is just me speaking personally now, that a non-binding IRP decision, as far as being precedent, I was scratching my head, you know, will it be subject to the same kind of all-in litigation that you want for a precedential question and a precedential decision to have, you know, the panel to have at hand all of the sort of contested information that they might get. And so anyway, that was the basis and the backdrop. And so I wasn't trying to suggest that is within our remit. I was asking, is this in our remit? Should we, you know, if we decide a non-binding IRP is not appealable, and we can decide that, I think, should we look at the question of precedence, or should we pass that on to the community through the board? Thank you.
Thanks, David. And I certainly had understood that to be your intent. Sam.
Thanks, Susan. David, I don't know if you're prepared to talk about this now, or maybe you could circulate some information to the list. I'm having trouble understanding what we mean by a non-binding IRP. So if you could provide some more information about that, I just don't understand how that fits into the bylaws right now.
Thank you, Sam. Apologies, I'm having a real problem there with the mute button. It's bylaw 4.3X, and in 4.3X, section 4 says, by submitting a claim to the IRP panel, a claimant thereby agrees that the IRP decision is intended to be final binding arbitration. Any claimant that does not consent to an IRP being final binding arbitration may initiate a non-binding IRP if ICANN agrees, provided that such a non-binding IRP is not intended to be and shall not be enforceable. And so the potential exists, you know, maybe ICANN would adopt a position. We're not going to do that. I don't know, but strikes me that the potential is certainly there for a non-binding IRP.
David, you're going in and out of audio a little. So sometimes you're easy to hear, and sometimes you're quite faint.
I need to hold the mic in front of me. I'm sorry, but I was pointing to 4.3X, subsection 4. I think that's a provision where there at least is the potential for a non-binding IRP.
Thanks, David. Okay, Cavus. Cavus, I am not hearing
Yes, perfect. Because you have not properly pronounced my name. I just say Tavit. No, okay, you're pronouncing my name. I'm sorry. I don't need any explanation for non-binding IRP. I oppose to that, clearly, bluntly, and openly. It is against the objective of the very objective IRP. I don't understand non-binding. Why we do all of these things for non-binding? And if we don't discuss non-binding, we don't need to discuss whether it's contestable or non-contestable. So I oppose to non-binding RIP. I don't know where it's come from. Thank you.
So Cavus, I think the point is that there is a reference to it in the bylaws. But certainly what we are doing here is where the expectation is that the IRPs would be binding in the majority of cases, and that's what we are working towards. But David rightly flagged that there is this provision in the bylaws, and we have it on our list to talk about in the future. I hope that makes sense. Okay, I'm not seeing any other. Oh, Kurt, sorry, I missed you.
Oh no, that's all right. I just re-raised my hand because I wanted to make sure the previous discussion was exhausted, which I think it is. Anyway, my advice that might not be worth much is, and you might have already anticipated all of this, is, and through my own painful experience, is that one way subgroups fail is that the issues are relitigated when they come to the big groups. And there's two ways to sort of address this. Like I said, you probably already thought of this, but one is, you know, as subgroups develop their thinking, to report up the direction in which they're heading as they do work, so that the final product is not a surprise to anyone, and feedback's garnered along the way, so that when the final product is done, there's a high chance of acceptance by the whole group. And then secondly, you know, in a representative group where each stakeholder group or constituency is represented, you'd want to have, you know, a critical mass of people. So we're stretched a little thin here. And, but somebody from each constituency or stakeholder group to make sure all viewpoints are taken into account, even at the subgroup level. We don't have that luxury here. We're more of a mishmash, but we do have, you know, after a long time of working together, some identification of, you know, who argues on what side of what issues. So when the subgroups are formed, I think we'd want to try to take care that, you know, there's a diversity of thinking in every subgroup so that, again, when the final product's delivered, it's not antithetical to some others' thinking. So that's my big advice. Thanks.
Thanks, Kurt. That's really helpful. I think those are really good points, and we'll take them on board. You know, it may be that I may be needing to encourage some people to join a particular subgroup, or indeed it might even be that if we just, you know, if it doesn't look as though we can get a kind of representative group on a particular topic, we might need to just reserve that one to the full working group if we need to. But yes, thank you very much for those good suggestions. Okay, I don't really want to spend any longer on this, and I'm not seeing any further hands. So I think we can wrap this this sort of discussion up, but just you know, urging people to have a look at the groups and think about putting your hand up for one or more of them. And hopefully we can get that work underway. Probably not before ICANN 72, since it's, you know, coming up fairly promptly. But you know, we can hopefully get that going soon thereafter. So circling back now, just to it's not specifically agendaed, except as part of one of the action items held over, which is Malcolm's the document that Malcolm circulated with his suggestion about how we might introduce a sort of a level of sort of reasonableness and fairness into the idea of allowing time for other accountability mechanisms before, without putting the claimant in an IRP out of time for filing. Malcolm, I think you've joined us. I hope you're still here. Yes, there you are. Sorry, you were off my screen. I wonder, would you be willing to just very quickly introduce your document and sort of explain your thinking, and we will perhaps see if anyone has any immediate reaction. But I don't want us to spend the whole call discussing it. I think it warrants people having time to think about it and provide some feedback on the list, and we can perhaps have that on the agenda for next week. So if you wouldn't mind sort of a very kind of whistle stop tour, but just before you start, Cavus, you have your hand up. Is that a new hand? So Cavus, do you wish to have the microphone?
Yes, Susan. I said that I don't want you to discuss something and leave it as it is. We should have some sort of at least conclusion on that. I remember that this non-binding RIP better discuss it in the work stream and so on and so forth. But it's a very rare exceptional cases. If that happened, no doubt it would be uncontestable, because when it is not binding, we cannot contest something which is not binding. So it is a waste of time. But I would like that either you or Becky, who was dealing with this issue many years ago, or David, provide information where and how and what circumstances, not now, at the next meeting, for this non-binding IRP occurs. We should not generalize that at all. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. Well, perhaps why don't I just circulate after this call, well, not today, but before the next call, the bylaws section in question. It's not for us to discuss now. I was just simply flagging on that it is on our list of outstanding items and has been on that list now for about a month. And it is not something that we are putting into one of the subgroups, but it is something for us to consider whether it's within scope for us to spend some time looking at it. So I hear your comments, and I'm sure you will be you'll be wishing to make those comments again when we, as a group, consider whether that's something that we should and indeed could spend time looking at or not. So thanks for that. Your comment is noted. Malcolm, over to you.
Thank you, Susan, and my apologies for being late to join this meeting. I'm afraid other business prevented me arriving on time. No disrespect was intended to my colleagues here. So this presentation I put together attempts to somewhat summarize and then build upon the discussion that we were having in our last call about whether it was really could be possible to get the benefits that we get from tolling time without necessarily having some of the downsides that Sam was identifying, that tolling time could extend the duration, the elapsed time between the elapsed calendar time between an event that was challenged and the ultimate outcome of the IRP more than desirable and maybe more than possibly more than necessary with an alternative solution. So here we've attempted to sort of examine those points and look at the solution that was discussed last time and give that a sort of evaluation. So if you can flick through the slides, because I don't have control of the slides on the screen. The first slide, I've just given a definition of what tolling means, but basically just don't count the days for a process that's tolled. Next slide, please. So the first, then we identify the purposes. The first purpose of tolling then is simply to make sure that the time doesn't run out for the claimant. They're not unable to bring an IRP claim simply because they're engaged in another process instead. And we should remember that our job here is actually to create rules that help claimants to bring their IRP claims in a timely fashion so that we can get these disputes resolved. And if we don't put in place things that enable that to happen, then we're really falling in our duty. So that's one of the reasons for tolling. Next slide. There are, however, some next slide, please. There are, however, some subsidiary benefits here that you get from it. By taking away the negative incentive that is the fear that time might run out during the process, you actually encourage using the non-IRP processes that exist, which might otherwise be avoided by claimants. And that could result in us saving time, saving money by actually either resolving the dispute without needing an IRP or at least narrowing the scope of what needs to go to an IRP. And one thing that came up in particular is if you can actually agree a set of facts so that the IRP is only on the rules, but not the facts, that can dramatically reduce the area under contention and the difficulty of what's done. You know, you don't have to worry all the stuff about whether or not you'd have witnesses, whether the old issues have to have problems that need to be, you know, people's minds have faded and all that stuff. None of that appears if you've actually agreed a set of facts. So that's an important benefit there as well. There's also the issue that tolling, if a claimant actually starts another process and then abandons it prematurely, says actually, you know what, we're going to stop this before it's resolved its outcome, just because I've got to go and file an IRP now, then that would create a lot of wasted work. So tolling would reduce that from happening. And finally, Tulling, another benefit that the Tulling gives to the benefit to the claimant is that they don't have to actually engage in multiple processes in parallel, which could be a lot of work for them. Okay, next slide, please. Now, there are downsides, however, to Tulling. And the first one is simply that it extends the duration. And the aim of the IRP is to get things done as quickly as possible. So that in itself can be considered a downside. Secondly, there was a fear that was expressed that a party could, going into processes knowing that they're told, just use that to game the system, to spin things out, even if the process that's being initiated is unnecessary, futile, there's really no point to it. The only thing it's doing is to create a delay. That was certainly a fear that was mentioned in the last meeting by Sam. One might think that there were other, you know, if the other party could collapse a process that's being gamed in that way, that might mitigate it. But nonetheless, that fear was raised. And finally, if you do Tulling, the flip side of not actually forcing the claimant to engage in two things in parallel is that actually there's no incentive for the claimant to engage in multiple processes in parallel, which means that there's no incentive to save the elapsed time that could be done by working a little harder in parallel. So that's the downsides of Tulling. Next slide, please. So that raises the question, is it possible that there's something or some alternative to Tulling that would exist that would deliver the benefits that we've listed of Tulling, but avoid the downsides that we've listed? Next slide, please. So the alternative idea that came up was the idea of supplementary time. So under that, you wouldn't tell the time in a process, but you would guarantee to the claimant a fixed period at the end of the process in which to file the IRP, so that they wouldn't have their time expired during that other process. And by example, essentially what would, you know, by example here that I've set out, suppose that the claimant wishes to file an IRP, the clock starts on day zero. If after 60 days, for example, they were to file a reconsideration request, for example, and that took the full 135 days to complete, they would then be out of time under the, if there was no tulling, yeah? But we could say, actually, we'll give you 60 days after the request for reconsideration to complete, to file the IRP as part of the rules, as an alternative rule on deadline for filing. Yeah, and that would give them the 60 days, so they would be able to do the RFR before doing an IRP, but they wouldn't get a full 135 days that the RFR took, which is what we'd be giving them if we decided to toll the RFR. So it would be a compromise there. And that compromise could potentially satisfy the benefits and potentially significantly mitigate the downsides of tulling. So that was the idea of why that would be a compromise. Next slide, please. So this is just looking back at those lists of benefits and problems with tulling and seeing which ones are satisfied. And actually all of these seem to be satisfied by this, except for the issue that it would be forcing the claimant to work on two processes at once, which could be a burden to the claimant in some circumstances. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. So when would it be appropriate? It seems that this alternative option might well be considered fair if we believe the claimant ought to be preparing their IRP claim for filing in parallel with conducting another accountability process. On the other hand, it might not be considered fair, the flip side of that, if we believe either of the two things. If we believe that lack of foreknowledge of the outcome of that other process prevents or significantly inhibits the claimant from preparing their claim in parallel, i.e. if they've got to know the outcome of the other process in order to be able to file their IRP properly, then this option might not be fair. And also, if conducting two processes in parallel is seen as placing an undue burden on the claimant, then you might also consider it not fair. And final slide, please, the next slide and the final slide. then looking at the processes that we have, and here's a possible assessment of what of how you would come up, how you would come out by applying those considerations. For the RFR, well, firstly, we note that the RFR process doesn't really have any opportunity for the claimant to engage in an RFI process once they filed it. So there's not an ongoing set of work being done, which means there's not really a burden on the claimant of having the two processes going in parallel. So the idea that this might be an undue burden on the claimant really doesn't apply for the RFR. And secondly, for the RFR, the outcome is pretty predictable. Now, I may be mistaken about this, but my understanding is that it tends towards the binary. It's either your request is accepted and they go off and do it again, or it's rejected, in which case you've lost, and then you're really your only option then is to do it, file an IRP. And that's very predictable, very clear. So, and you're not really going to be using anything that came out of the RFR in order to file your IRP because you're just being told no. So that makes it look like for the RFR, the compromise option would really work. And we could say that we won't toll for the RFR and instead have some supplementary time option as an alternative to tolling. And that could be a good compromise. For the ombudsman, the outcome, there's not really an outcome in that sense, so it's not at all clear. There is some active engagement needed by the claimant in like talking to the ombudsman, but is that really onerous? Would that really meet the standard of it being unreasonable to expect them to do both at once? You take a view on that. My own view is actually it sounds reasonable to me, but maybe others would have a different view. For the DIDP, the document disclosure policy, the issue is that whether to file an IRP and the contents of what you actually write in your IRP claim may well depend entirely on the contents of the documents that come out of that process, that only come out at the end of it. And therefore, as a result, you may not really be able to do that work in parallel because you haven't seen the documents that come out of that process yet. And so for that, it might be reasonable to assess that as this compromise wouldn't work for that process for that reason, in which case the implication would be that tolling is required for DIDP. And for CEP, the cooperative engagement process, that's a very active process of negotiation between the claimant and an ICANN. That's potentially as time consuming or as effortful as actually putting your case before the IRP would be. And so you might well consider then that expecting to do that at the same time as building your IRP case is potentially an undue burden. And it also gets the claimant into the wrong mindset. On the one hand, the CEP, you're supposed to be negotiating and reaching a solution, whereas the IRP, when you're filing, you're trying to build your strongest claim. So they might actually be mutually antagonistic processes, really. So for that reason, you might say that, again, this compromise option might not be considered appropriate for the CEP process. And the implication of that would be that tolling is required for the CEP. And so you may, I would ask you to go away, consider the issues that were raised there and consider how you would conduct such an assessment. But certainly as a first pass, I think it's possible that this compromise option could provide a workable and reasonable solution for certainly for the RFR and quite possibly for the ombudsman as well, i.e. to say that neither of those processes need to be told. If there was instead a promise of sufficient time to file at the end of it. But the DIDP and the CEP probably do require tolling. This process would not be sufficient to meet the requirements there. My suggestion and submission here as to how we could go there. It would potentially bring us forward. And I think that actually, if we got the RFR out of tolling and into the supplementary time, might well mitigate significantly the concerns that Sam was raising in the last meeting. So I'd be very interested in ICANN Legal's reaction.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Malcolm. And thank you for your sort of thoughtful assessment. I thought it was incredibly useful. I found it really useful as well. It's been really handy to have the kind of thinking of you know, why we're tolling and what the pros and cons are set out in that way, and really appreciate it. I don't want to cut discussion off unduly, but at the same time, I do want us to have time to go back to the safety valve on the repose. And I am also conscious that not everyone's here, not everyone will have had time to really consider what you're proposing. And so it does merit people taking some time to think about this. And I would like us to have a really substantive discussion on the next call. But I do have a couple of hands, and particularly if anyone's got any questions for Malcolm that they, you know, where something isn't making sense to them or they want to clarify something in order to consider it, that would be really super helpful. But otherwise, I'm going to try and cut this off at the top of the hour if people don't mind. And with that, I will turn to Liz.
Thanks, Susan. And thank you, Malcolm, for the work, the thoughtful work that you put into this and trying to come to address the concerns that we raise and trying to come towards some kind of an agreement that we can all live with. Clearly, you put in a lot of time and we really appreciate it. I think from my ICANN Legal standpoint, obviously, we'll need to take this back and consider this some more and spend a little bit more time on it. And we'll come back and respond in a more substantive manner. But I think a couple of things just off the top of my head as you were going through this is it's still not clear to us how the tolling after a request for reconsideration really does end up providing some benefit to the IRP, because they are a request for reconsideration, as you know, it's an entirely different process that evaluates a different, going under a different standard than an IRP. So the a request for reconsideration looks at whether or not an ICANN board or staff action or inaction in terms of process itself violated the bylaws or the articles of incorporation. It does not look at the merits of the larger issue at hand that may be challenged, but just whether or not there was a failure in the process in reaching that decision. Whereas an IRP does look at the substantive merits of a decision. So a lot of times, what we saw in the last couple of years as it related to the new GTLD round, I think that this may be going to where you said that the results of an IRR is predictable, is that we had a lot of new GTLD applicants that try to challenge the merits of a decision that was made during any of the objection processes, whether it's legal rights, whether it's a community priority evaluation, by bringing it to the through the reconsideration process. And in all those instances, because the reconsideration process does not look at the merits of that decision, but only whether or not the panelists in making the objection determination failed to follow process. And in fact, then what happens is you saw that most of the people who then ended up getting their reconsideration denied because they were seeking a different remedy, a different standard, using the wrong accountability mechanism then went to really file an IRP, because that's what they should have done all along if they were challenging the merits. So I don't think in this you really gain anything. I don't think a claimant gains anything by having an additional 60 days after the reconsideration request has ended in order to file the IRP, because there's nothing coming out of the reconsideration request that would benefit the claimant in the IRP. Certainly, that there's no merits decision being made on that end in the IRP, in the reconsideration process. Now, the other thing is, you had mentioned that you want to be able to have additional time so that the claimants can agree on a set of facts that can go into an IRP, which of course would cut down the time of an IRP and would be beneficial to both parties. But that's the only way that an agreement on facts that are being litigated in IRP can carry through into the IRP is through the CEP. So, which goes back to our initial suggestion, tolling in the CEP addresses the concerns that you've highlighted. A tolling at the end of an RFR does not address these concerns. And I think the other thing is, well, we did raise gaming issues in our discussion so far. And that's not really the focus of our concerns here. What we're trying to do is move towards an appropriate and efficient resolution for what the issues that we're discussing. But it's just not clear to us that how doing by adding on additional time through the reconsideration process or even the DIDP process, which talks about which is seeking disclosure of documents, would somehow alleviate any prejudice that may come to a claimant who chose to pursue a different accountability mechanism rather than through an IRP. Thank you.
Thanks, Liz. So that was quite detailed. Obviously, it's some points that we've heard made previously. I think we will explore this all further, but I'm conscious, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about tolling of time limits. Generally, my feeling is that the group were largely agreed collectively that some form of that some time needed to be allowed so that a claimant could pursue other accountability mechanisms and not be time barred. And we, as I say, we've been talking about that for a very long time. So I'm hearing what you say, but perhaps you know you've said you want to think about this further, and so perhaps you know you could do that and come back on the list if you possibly can, and then we will have a much more substantive discussion on this next time around, if that's okay. And Cavus, I see your hand, and so I will come to you, but. Please bear in mind that we will have a substantive discussion on this next week.
I'm very sorry. You don't allow me to raise a question?
No, I do allow you to raise a question. Yeah, please,
but
do.
Liz made a very comprehensive comment, which was not necessary at this stage. Let us limit to point of clarification. That's all. We don't discuss it. That means we don't discuss it. And then Liz says, "Us? Who is us?"
Please do. Have a question?
Wait, please. Even yourself, kindly, allow question for clarification. Malcolm, is it only 60 days or it goes more than that? Yes or no?
I think it's open to this group to set whatever period that it thinks would be
appropriate. Yeah, okay, thank you very much. If it is more than 60 days, I don't discuss it. But 60 days, I am not in favor of what Lee said, that it makes it unproductive. 60 days does not make a big thing for all those things. Let us discuss it next week or later on. So you said that it may be any time, 6 months or 1 year. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay, so yes, thanks for everyone. Please do, if you possibly can, it would be very good to share your thoughts by email so that we're coming into the next week call with views and perspectives on this flushed out somewhat for us to then discuss further. Thanks very much. And again, thank you very much to Malcolm for this work. Okay, next up, we have on our agenda to come back to the safety valve language on the repose. Brenda, we have that in a Google Doc, and we have some comments from various people that have been made and suggestions for edits. And so I'd like us to specifically look at those if we can, and see if we can find a sort of path forward on that language. So is it possible to pull up the Google Doc, Brenda?
Yes, one moment, please. Is this the right one?
Yes, thank you. Okay, so you all have had a couple of weeks now with this language from Liz, I think it was, that was circulated before our previous call. And we've had some comments, I think all of these comments were made before our previous call. So we have looked at this document once, but not discussed in detail. And so what I'd really like to do is if we could go through just paragraph by paragraph and see whether the proposed amendments make sense and the comments make sense, and perhaps whether that gives us a form of language that we can move forward with, or indeed we maybe need to ask Liz to kind of address some of these comments and come back with a further draft. But to start off, the first comment is one that I made. It was proposing the return of the language material effect of the action or inaction. And we don't have this as the red line from the current rule, but I believe that this is in the current interim rules and was being proposed to be deleted. But it would be helpful to understand what the thinking was in that proposed deletion, Liz or Sam, because it seems to me that it changes the standard that's set in the bylaws, where in order to be a claimant, you have to not only be aware, but you also have to be actually material affected. And so if we remove the material effect bit, you could be a claimant who knows about the action or inaction, but you aren't an eligible claimant yet. And so my suggestion would be to keep that language in, but I guess since ICANN Legal proposed to delete it, I guess I was looking for some clarity on why that deletion was proposed. Alternatively, perhaps we're comfortable keeping it Sam.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. I don't think we have a big concern to keep it in. We'll go back and confirm with the other members of our team that we worked on. These edits weren't just from me and Liz. We'll confirm if there was any larger justification, but I don't see a reason to change it. So we should be fine keeping material effect in.
Sorry, I'm talking away on mute. Sorry, thank you for that. That's very helpful. And then in the next paragraph, we have a proposed deletion of some language that you had included about the under exceptional circumstances. And I think this is, yes, it's a comment that Flip had made that he felt that it was, it duplicated because there's a reference to the extraordinary circumstances a bit further down. And so I did, but I, my feeling was in reaction to Flip, I agree that there's some repetition, but I did wonder if perhaps you're including this first sentence to make it clear that the kind of intent of this is to that it's an there has to be an application to seek leave to file late, and that is sort of the point that is being made in that first sentence. So again, I guess this is kind of a question for Sam and Liz, or but for anyone else who has views on this to share as well. I'm not seeing any hands. Oh, Malcolm.
Well, if it's the intent is to create another procedural step, then I think I would suggest that we avoid multiplying the procedural steps that need to happen. With the deletion in place, the IRP panel may permit the claimant to file its thing if the requirements that we set out are met. That could potentially be when the claimant, they submit their claim and demonstrate it, and it's for the panel to decide whether that standard has been met. No additional steps needed. If you're asking there to be a sort of preliminary hearing or something on the separate issue of whether you should be allowed to file in the first place, that's going to potentially conflict with the actual dispute provider's provisions that require you to file in the first place. But it's also just multiplying the procedural elements and adding cost. Let's not do that.
Thanks, Malcolm. Kavus, I'm seeing your hand, but I think it's an old one that's been up for a while. So I'm going to go to Sam, but if it's not an old hand, then please let me know. Sam, why don't you, we'll go to you first.
Thanks, Susan. So we did intentionally have in here a step of a process to say this, we want to file, but we acknowledge it's after time. And then that can be decided and then the claim can be perfected, right? And we can do some work to reduce the duplicative nature of some of the wording in there. But I think that it's really important, and this is one of the things that we've learned through the process of doing the IRP over the past couple of years under the new bylaws and with the interim rules, is that there are places where there is a lack of clarity of process, where I understand Malcolm's concern that we don't want to add in process for process's sake. But I also think that there is a place where having process, an additional process in the right place, actually can help streamline things. And so if we have the panel identify just the issue of timeliness without going to a full examination of the merits, that actually creates that first process as a much narrower process. And it reduces, it could potentially reduce the full amount of time and effort that's needed for the IRP itself. And it's once the panel then says, proceed with your application, that you go to the merits and you don't find claimants and ICANN. And if we step back and remember, these are all, a lot of these costs for the panel time and everything, ICANN is responsible for paying those. Those are the ICANN community's money that's going to that. And you have the claimants who are then using their own attorneys and that too, that when you have more limited filings on targeted issues, it allows some of the gating questions to be handled. So we do think it's appropriate to take the opportunity to use some clarity of process when it's available, not for process sake, but to really streamline it. Because if the panel then says that the claimant is not able to file its IRP at the later date, and you've used time to then consider the merits as well, there's been a lot of wasted time and effort from all sides on considering that. So that's why we present this in this way.
Thanks, Sam. Okay, I'm not seeing any further hands on this point. I think that sounds to me like there are merits to both. Maybe we don't have firm agreement on this, but we will. I think let's park that one for now. But it's something for us to circle back to. Kavish, your hand is still up. Do you wish to speak? Okay, I'm not hearing from you, so I will keep going down the document. And the next comment is, I think we're back up just a little bit. Yes. The next comment is that highlighted section just in the middle regarding these are extraordinary circumstances and as drafted, it's caused by the claimant to prevent the claimant from becoming aware of the action being challenged in the dispute or from being able to file a written statement of dispute within whatever the time period is. And I flagged this one just to see whether as a group, people feel comfortable that this language as it's drafted would adequately cover a claimant where they might have been aware, but they were unable to file a claim in time because they were not yet materially affected and therefore were not eligible. So they're not eligible to be a claimant. Do we feel that this language covers that scenario? And if not, do we feel that that scenario is one that we are wanting to cover in this safety valve language, or are people comfortable with this as drafted? So again, just a question for the wider group, if anyone has strong feelings on this. If there are no strong feelings, then I guess we will stick with the language that ICANN Legal has proposed. Okay, all right, then we can move on to the next comment. And for some reason I'm struggling to see some of the comments in this in the chat, but I think the next comment is this proposed deletion, and I think there were sort of various group members who had expressed some concerns about this. It's that as drafted, there were proposed to be two prongs to bring one within eligibility for this late filing. The first being these extraordinary circumstances, and the second being that any relief requested, including requests for interim measures of protection by the claimant, if they were awarded or recommended by the panel, would not adversely affect any third party. I think off the top of my head, I think Flip maybe had proposed to delete that second prong. I had some concerns about it in terms of whether the impact of that language would be effectively to rule out every IRP, since there in many or indeed most IRPs, if the claimant is successful, then someone else is disadvantaged as a consequence. And I think Malcolm had also expressed some reservations about that language. I'm sorry that in the Zoom room we can't see all of the comments, but hopefully you have all read them in prior to this call. David.
Thank you, Susan. David McCauley speaking for the record. I had trouble inserting comments in this document, so I mentioned on list that I had a concern with number two, not so much a concern, but a question. How does a panel know whether someone's going to be adversely affected? I actually thought the second prong was fairly stated. You know, it was a fair concern because one of the things the IRP is intended to do, and one of the things that the IRP, I think, was drawn up to do, was to help in this towards the notion of finality and certainty. And so if someone is timed out, you know, they're given a time within which to make a claim. We haven't settled on what that might be, but if they've timed out, then that's it. Certainty and finality set in. And so if there's going to be an exception to that, I don't think it's an unfair inquiry to say, well, wait a minute, who would this, you know, who's going to be harmed by this? My question was, and I wasn't able to put it in the document. For some reason, I'm still having problems seeing things in the document. I don't know what the problem is, probably in my computer. But in any event, my concern was, you know, shouldn't we hand over to the consolidation group, you know, to think about how would a panel know? I mean, how do you flesh this out, or how do you raise the issue of unfairness to someone else? I think it's a fair concern. Thank you.
Malcolm.
Thank you. I support the deletion of this clause. The reason is that it proceeds on a mistaken understanding of the nature of the relief available. In order for this clause to be triggered, you must assume that a relief that could be given would harm a third party. If relief is not available that would harm a third party, then this clause is completely not necessary. However, the only relief that is available under the IRP is a declaration that something that ICANN has done is inconsistent with the bylaws. There is no other form of relief available, and there is no direct effect to the panel's rulings. It is for the board to decide, having had a ruling that something is inconsistent with the bylaws, how it should proceed on the basis of that. It is therefore also for the board to decide how it should balance necessary and proper and potentially urgent need to come back into consistency with the bylaws with the legitimate interests of any third parties that may apply. It is therefore not for the panel to consider the interests of third parties. It is for the board, as the board is the one that is deciding what to do about a finding of incompatibility. So this clause is misplaced for that reason and should be removed. Thank you.
Thanks, Malcolm. Again, I'm not seeing any other hands. that you know, what you say certainly has some resonance with me. And I, as I say, I can't see all of the comments in this particular format, but I do think that we had, you know, quite a number of comments expressing concern about this provision. I mean, I wonder if perhaps we could ask Sam if you and your colleagues could look at this again. And I mean, it may be that you were trying to build in a sort of an element of fairness, having regard to what the impact would be on a late claim IRP. But it seems to me that it currently effectively impacts, you know, it's drafted currently very broadly, and so, you know, the relief being requested, for example, I'm taking Malcolm's point, but nevertheless, the claimant is asking for the reversal of a decision. And so whilst the IRP outcome can't reverse the decision, this is based on the relief being claimed, and that does have a potential direct knock-on effect to whoever was the beneficiary of that previous decision.
If they're asking for a reversal of the decision to the IRP panel, their claim is miswritten.
Well, I mean, effectively, that is what you're asking, isn't it?
No, it's effectively, it's not the same thing. Yeah, it is. It may well be the case in many cases that a finding of incompatibility leaves the board with an incredibly powerful and almost unanswerable case for withdrawing the decision and starting again. But that is, nonetheless, it is in the board's hands for that. And there may be circumstances where that's not the case and where they don't. And the circumstances that are envisaged in this clause are exactly the sorts of times when the board might have to do it. Anyway, the point being is that it's not for the panel to decide that. It's for the board to decide that. I would have thought that ICANN Legal would be very protective of the board's preserved authority in this area, and maybe if I yield the floor to Sam now, she will have thought again about the merits of this clause.
Yeah, let's do that. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Malcolm, and also thanks to David for the point that you raised. This is part of the heart of the issue, I think. One of the things that we see, even in IRPs that are filed today, are people asking for relief beyond the bounds of what Malcolm expressed as what he's heard us say many times, what's in the bylaws, you know, what the limitations of the IRP is, which is a declaration as to whether or not ICANN violated its bylaws or not. And then he's correct that Malcolm is correct, right? Then it's up to the board to decide how to proceed with that decision and how to give effect to that decision. But really, often what we see, and I think that this is part of what some of my colleagues were reacting to in drafting this language, is we still see, and you can go look at IRP filings that say, we want, part of the relief we want this panel to do is to make ICANN reverse its decision and put this contract into effect and take away that contract. And so we do have issues where people are actively seeking relief that is not appropriate under the bylaws, but also is directly targeted to third parties. So it's a bit of a dance, right?
But surely, Sam, the place where the proper place for refuting such ill-drafted claims and such ill-directed claims is in your defence and not in the bylaw, not in the rules of procedure.
Well, you know what. In hearing this conversation, we'll definitely take this back and look at it again in light of what we've discussed here. Because Malcolm, I really do appreciate the point that you've raised and how you framed it. I think it's you've expressed it in an extremely compelling way. But we also have there are other concerns. But I think that the other question that you're saying is, aren't there other places to raise those concerns? And there might be. So, so that, and David's question of who's responsible for being the voice of the third parties, right? If this comes up, I think is also a very interesting question and definitely tied to the issue of consolidation and notice to others. So, you know, I think we have some really meaty points to take back and think about to provide some further reflection back to the IoT.
Thanks very much for that, Sam. David, did you want to comment on this, or was it on another topic?
It was on this. I just wanted to say something real quick. I'll be quick.
Please do.
I'm glad Sam is going to take it back. Malcolm made a good case, and I think it's worthwhile to take it back. I don't agree with Malcolm. I do think that the standard for an IRP is whether the board took an action or inaction that violated the articles or bylaws. But when they take an action, it's actually, you know, a human action expressed in words, usually. And it can be close. It can be a close decision. They may say, for instance, that X is in the public interest, and an IRP panel may disagree and say, no, X is not in the public interest. When ICANN says X is in the public interest and no one presents a claim in a timely manner, then the community says, okay, X is in the public interest. We can rely on that. That's what I'm getting at. There are close calls and as to whether something violated the articles or bylaws. And so I do think this is possible, that third parties could be inappropriately affected. Thank you.
Thanks, David. So we'll, for present purposes, we'll leave this with Sam, Liz, and their colleagues. I think there's one other proposed as it. We've got 4 minutes left, but let's just quickly look at the one in paragraph C. Paragraph C itself is just a sort of, I believe, is just where Flip had suggested that sat better as an independent paragraph rather than being at the end of paragraph B. So the text in blue is not really the new text. But I think the addition of the term at the end affecting the claimant is something that is more substantive, since it does have, that does sort of does impact the duration or the how long that 4 year term might be. I think as proposed by ICANN Legal, it was an absolute cutoff of 4 years from the date of the disputed action or inaction. As proposed to amend it, it would be 4 years from when that disputed action or inaction has impacted the particular claimant in question. Again, any particular views on this or anyone wanting to talk to it? And David, I don't know, is that a new hand?
It is a new hand, and I apologize. I have not been able to see the comments in the document for some reason. But this language that appears to me in purple, the language at the end says affecting the claimant, I don't think that has any effect in that sentence. I think it's meaningless, because what the sentence seems to me to be talking about is after the date of the disputed action or inaction, not the effect, but the date of the action. That's the way I read that sentence. And I think that's proper. Thanks.
Sam.
Thanks, Susan. So this 4 year date was placed in recognition of the fact that there is a 4 year breach of contract statute of limitations in California. And that's the jurisdiction that most of our agreements are subject to, or contracted party agreements. And we thought that it was important to really tether the outer limit of this to a breach of contract claim, because if ICANN wound up being told that its actions were in violation of the articles of incorporation or bylaws, and therefore in acting on it needed to undo certain actions that could trigger a breach of contract claim from other parties. And so we needed to, we wanted to really tether it to that date, to make sure that that we were preserving remedies kind of in a broader sense as well. So this would be timed from the act itself as opposed to any measurement of impact. That's what we're proposing.
Okay. Okay, thanks for that clarification. Malcolm?
No, sorry, I don't follow that at all. I just don't understand the reasoning there. What has this got to do with a contractual dispute? What we're talking about here is an internal governance matter. We are asking for a ruling on whether something did or did not act consistent, was or was not consistent with the bylaws. Nothing more nor less. It's not tethered to a contract. It might, the subject matter might relate to a decision in a contract. Who knows? It may or may not. Even if it did, firstly, you still come back to the issue that we mentioned and agreed on a moment ago. It's for the board to decide what to do about that. What is the relationship of the, even if ICANN felt that it needed to do something as a result of this that would place it in breach of contract with the contract that it has signed, and were felt compelled in order to become consistent with its bylaws and to break a contract and then to come to some arrangement with a third party as a result of that. I still don't see that how that position would be in any way improved in any way relates to the statute of limitations on that. It's just an entirely separate issue. To be honest, I don't see that this clause relates to that at all. This is actually about when the start date for the clock is, and there's another example of ICANN Legal's attempt to tether the start date to the action rather than to the impact on the claimant and the claimant's knowledge as set out in the bylaws.
Okay. Thanks, Malcolm. Your point is heard. We're out of time. We will obviously be coming back to this. Sam's already taken an action item to look at this language again and circulate a new draft. Sam, if at all possible, if we could have something before the next call, which is next week, that would be extremely helpful, as it would allow people to come into the next call ready to discuss the new draft. We will then spend our time next week. We will come back to Malcolm's tolling proposal and have a more substantive discussion on that. And we will be, I hope, able to look at this repose language. Sam.
With prep week being this week and many members of our legal team are already kind of fully booked, I really don't know that I could commit to delivering this in advance of next week. I apologize. We are not going to be able to internally have the time needed to get this done by next week.
Okay. Thanks, Sam. In which case we will spend our time on the next call talking about the tolling, and we may wrap up slightly early if we don't need the full 90 minutes. Thanks very much, everyone. Apologies for running over time, but thanks again for everyone's engagement, and I think we are making progress here, or at least I hope we are. So we can stop the recording now, we can hopefully, please do share views on tolling by email on our list so that we can go into next week's call having sort of flushed out the issues. Okay, thanks very much.